So I want to talk to you tonight about the value of discomfort. And it may not be what you came for. Usually we come to classes like this to find out how to be more comfortable, right? To find more peace and ease in our lives. But I've really come to recognize the value of basically tolerating, learning to be okay with levels of discomfort in our lives and certainly in our practice, because it's that kind of edge that actually allows us to grow. It's that place in our experience where new things can happen, where we learn, where we change. And of course, any sense of adventure we might have, any sense of the new, usually involves some level of discomfort. And so shifting our relationship from avoidance to valuing can really make a huge difference for us. Because in our lives and in our meditation practice, we tend to cycle through three states. And some of us will spend more time in one or the other, but we'll all know these three of comfort, discomfort, and overwhelm. Now, most of us, right, what are we trying to do? Be comfortable. We're trying to manipulate experience, manipulate our surroundings, our environment, so we're in that state of comfort in our homes, in our work environments, in the people we spend time with. And so we choose to do things that we feel comfortable with a lot of the time, to be around people that we're comfortable with, and that often means they're very similar to us. Similar in background, in economic class, in racial background. So we have that sense of comfort or ease. We can choose people because we have a similarity of interests or career or family situation, because there's that ease, that familiarity. Now, anything I say, I'm not saying this is bad or wrong, but just to notice how we do that and how many choices we make based on that seeking of comfort, to bring it more into consciousness. Because we can really develop strong habit patterns out of this search for comfort. And these habits get very deeply conditioned. Habits basically get created to increase our level of comfort and to reduce the expenditure of energy in making decisions. It's like, I don't know, you guys, I haven't been here before. Do you always tend to sit in the same spot in the hall? When you go walking, you go to the same place. It's like back in the high school, you know, where you went in the cafeteria. On retreat, we certainly see those patterns, right? The walking place, we're in the dining room. We do it all the time. We create these habits. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is a value to that. As I said, it can really lessen the expenditure of energy of always deciding, how do I do this? Where do I go? What do I do? But they can solidify to the extent that they don't actually allow us to experiment. And we can find ourselves stuck in habit patterns, and I just mentioned very simple ones about where we sit or walk or whatever, what foods we eat. But it can really solidify so that we lose the capacity to have choice in those areas. And often these habits may have served us in the past, but don't serve us any longer. So being aware of the limitations that we might place on ourselves through this tendency to fall into the habit pattern, to fall into these routines that are familiar, that are comfortable, and then don't allow us to question and to experiment, to expand and to grow. Now, as I said at the beginning, we do come to meditation, most of us, if not all of us, to increase the level of comfort of ease in our lives. Maybe we've had some stress or suffering, and meditation seems like a wonderful antidote to that. And that's definitely true. You know, it's why modalities like MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, I mean, they called it that to really highlight how meditation can help us deal with stress in our lives, with chronic pain, with all of the other challenges that we might have. And that's wonderful. Meditation can do that. But if we're serious practitioners, we have to remember that that's not the ultimate goal. Reducing stress, being a little more comfortable, finding more ease. It wasn't what the Buddha taught the Dhamma for. One of the lines he said is, the reason I was successful in my quest for full enlightenment was I was never satisfied with just wholesome states of mind. This is not what he was teaching for. They're valuable, they're actually essential on the path, but they're not the goal. And I would include comfort, and seeking comfort in that teaching. Now, the other end of comfort is where many of us are a lot of the time, and much of this society is actually its effect is that we live in states of chronic stress, where there's just so much input and so much challenge that there's actually a toll it takes on the body and the mind. Mental and physical stress really can have a negative impact on our well-being, certainly psychologically as we feel that contraction of pressure and stress, but it can affect us physically, our health, our digestion, all of these things. I think it was a friend who's a doctor who said something like 90% of the people who come to him with something or another going on, when he traces it back, it's stress. There was something that happened and it led to this sense of overwhelm and all of these challenges mentally and physically. And when that happens, especially if it happens in a chronic way, ongoing, that's when we can get into overwhelm. It can happen over chronic stress, but certainly acute stress too. If there's some challenging situation, our own health, well-being, the health and well-being of loved ones, that's when we go into overwhelm. And what happens then is we shut down because we can't deal with what's happening. We push it away, we run away, we get into management mode of just trying to deal with what's happening. Often we numb out because we can't tolerate what's happening. This is not obviously a useful strategy, certainly not one for waking up and being more present. So we all need to know how to work with overwhelm, because we will experience it sooner or later. Perhaps you're in it right now, or recently had experiences of overwhelm. It's such a common experience. So we can use our mindfulness practice to work with that. Very helpful. One of the first understandings or insights we can have about it is, just because we're having an intense experience, it doesn't mean that we've done something wrong, or that even something is wrong, or that we can't deal or be with this situation, that we need to go into the numbing and the pushing away. What can happen when we have this impact of chronic or sudden stress is, there's that's called the first arrow, the dukkha of whatever is happening. But what the Buddha pointed us to notice is the second arrow, the second dart, which is all of the mind movements that say, this shouldn't be happening. Not me, not now. Well, I'm like, if not now, when? You know, well, next week, this would be good for this to happen, just not today. No, we always go, not now. This is a bad time for this to happen. When's a good time for something bad to happen? We're never really prepared for it. But all of those mind movements of not now, not me, why this, it's unfair, it shouldn't be happening, it's their fault, it's my fault, whatever it is, however we resist and contract away from, bring aversion to the situation, this is the second arrow where we can really bring our mindfulness to bear on that and to understand more what's happening and actually see if we can open to it. What I've learned for myself, and certainly in working with other people as a teacher, is we can tolerate far more than we give ourselves credit for. The mind, its initial response is to retract, recoil, but if we're willing, if we're able to just keep meeting the moment, it's amazing what this human heart and mind can open to, can be with. I mean, just don't think of all the suffering in your life, in my life, in life on the planet here. It's incredible. But to actually bring this into consciousness, to use this as part of our path, this is where mindfulness can really make a difference. I like some of the writings by Eckhart Tolle, that German teacher, self-awakened. In his book New Earth, he talks a lot about thought and how we really create a lot of our suffering, if not all of our suffering, through the our thinking mind. And he said in that book, one of the ego's many erroneous assumptions, one of its many deluded thoughts is, I should not have to suffer. Sometimes the thought gets transferred to someone close to you, my child should not have to suffer. That thought itself lies at the root of suffering. Suffering has a noble purpose, the evolution of consciousness and the burning up of the ego. As long as you resist suffering, it is a slow process because the resistance creates more ego to burn up. When you accept suffering, however, there is an acceleration of that process, which is brought about by the fact that you suffer consciously. You can accept suffering for yourself, or you can accept it for someone else, such as your child or parent. In the midst of conscious suffering, there is already the transmutation. The fire of suffering becomes the light of consciousness. So it's really a radical way to view suffering. It's what the Buddha talked about in the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. The Second Noble Truth is to understand it, to see the cause of suffering. With each of these truths and practices, we're asked to understand suffering, to know it, not to turn away from it, to see its nature, to see its cause. So we can actually move into these experiences. We don't have to flee them, we don't have to numb out, we don't have to contract or resist. We can actually be there and use our mindfulness practice to keep inviting us into this present moment experience, to rebalance. And again, many of you know, there's just the power of being with something, with mindfulness, as opposed to thinking about it, as opposed to trying to get rid of it or manipulate it, but just to be with it as it is. When we're in that overwhelm mode, there's often a lot of thinking, as Eckhart Tolle points out, and it exaggerates the fear component. It's like, oh my God, you know, I can kind of bear this moment, but what about the next moment? Or what about tomorrow? Or what about next week? That I know I can't bear. And so we get in this cycle, this spiral of fear and contraction about something that hasn't even happened yet. Mark Twain has this, the American humorist, has this great line, my life has been a series of one disaster after the other, most of which never happened. And you know, look how much of your mind stream you have spent on creating disaster scenarios of what might happen and how few have actually ever come true in the way you imagined them. I mean, you know, there are parts of the world where unfortunately those disaster scenarios are very real and true, but for most of us we have a lot of blessings, whatever the challenges we might have. So to actually turn towards whatever it is that we're working with, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, whether it's for us or someone else, and look at that experience, be with that experience in a really felt sense, a really physical way, and look at the stories that we're telling ourselves about what's happening. James Barras, who I'm sure many of you know, a teacher at Spirit Rock and in the East Bay, likes to ask people, what story are you believing right now? And I like to tell people, just encapsulate whatever it is, whatever drama, whatever challenge, make a sentence of it, a really short sentence, something like, you know, I can't be happy unless, or, you know, it's their fault that, or, well, the problem is this, whatever it is, a really short sentence. So you can start to actually bring clarity. What is it I'm believing about this? How am I relating to that? And start to question some of the assumptions about what's happening. I also like the work of Byron Katie to work with these kind of coalesced, solidified belief systems. She's great at challenging how we take ideas and make them solid and true, especially about ourselves. Byron Katie, she's again another self-awakened person. I don't know where she lives now. She used to be around the Marin a lot in the Bay Area, but she's quite brilliant. And she has what she calls the work. Many of you may know it, but it's just really good when we have a situation where we're believing something to be true, solid, real, and overwhelming us. And she says we should ask first. So she says also, tell the story, whether it's in a sentence or a little longer, you write it out. And then she asks you, is it true? And your first response is, damn right it's true. You know, they did do that, and they said that, and they shouldn't have, and whatever it is that you're believing about the story. But then she says, is it really true? Is it 100% true? Is it true all the time? Is it always going to be true? And yes, you start to question that story, that belief. You have to kind of admit that, well, perhaps not all the time, or not in 50 years' time, or whatever way you look at it, just to start to work with that solidity of the belief. And then she has you feel into, who are you when you believe that? What does that feel like when you take that belief, that limiting, that narrow, that aversive belief? Who are you when you believe? What does that feel like when you believe that? And then what does it feel like when you don't believe that? To feel the lightness that can come, the spaciousness, the expansion. And then the last one is she has you turn it around, reverse that. What if the complete opposite were true? How does that feel? And I just think that's a brilliant way of challenging when we've got a solidified belief about something, a sense of overwhelm, or I can't be happy unless, or this problem is insurmountable, actually to look at what's going on in the mind and how we're holding that, and to see if by actually moving towards it, being in it, might bring more freedom than trying to run away from it. So in our mindfulness practice, we actually open to what's the felt sense as we hold that experience, as we open to it, what's happening in the mind and the body. It's the heart of our practice. Being with experience as it is, knowing it and naming it. You know, the Buddha taught this practice 2600 years ago. Know if the mind is filled with greed or non-greed, aversion or non-aversion, delusion or non-delusion. Name them, know them, and then start to understand them. But that was the Buddha. Now we know it's true because someone wrote about it in the New York Times. This definitely works. I read an article a little while ago called The Importance of Naming Your Emotions by Tony Schwartz. And it's actually interesting. I mean, I sometimes joke about all this research that's being done that's validating what we as meditators all know and what the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. But it makes it, and it does have an impact, that they're actually researching some of these mindful strategies and finding they're really powerful. So Tony Schwartz just mentions a number of studies that have validated the power of just naming an emotion, not doing anything more than that, but just knowing, oh, this is anger or fear. And so he now brings that into his workplace. He's some kind of consultant, and he'll start a meeting by checking in, and not just, you know, how are you, fine, you, fine, yes, good, whatever, had a holiday in Hawaii, whatever, but really what are the feelings present? And inviting people to bring in a way they normally wouldn't, what they're really feeling, sadness or fear or anxiety. And he said it makes a huge difference in the capacity of people to be present and bring all of themselves into the meeting. So, validating what we already know, that it's powerful just to name what's happening, or this is fear, or confusion, or desire, or doubt. And that enables us to actually connect. And it's a doorway then. You know, many different strategies after that point of how we work with that, but so helpful. Why on retreats many of you have been exposed to this practice, the acronym of RAIN, R-A-I-N, recognition, R for recognition, A for acceptance or acknowledging, I, we used to say investigation, but I like more interest, or I heard another teacher describe it as intimacy, getting close to something, feeling the texture of it, the nuance of it, and then N for not personal, or non-identification, just to see that all of this is arising according to conditioned nature. It's not your fault, you're not to blame, you're not in control, but you do have a choice. Not in control, but you do have a choice now as you bring the mindfulness in. So RAIN is so helpful to actually allow us to see we can be with this. We can know this experience and actually bring mindfulness to it. And so as the mind steadies, as it drops into more presence and more connectedness, these beautiful qualities can start to really be our supports of equanimity or compassion, metta or kindness. Equanimity where we just acknowledge this is how things are right now. As difficult as they are, as much as I mightn't like it, this is how it is. It's like this right now. Because no matter how much meditation we do, no matter how much experience we've had, we will get out of balance. Stuff will happen that will challenge us. It's the nature of life to be unpredictable, to be not in our control. But to have some basic faith that by actually being willing to open to experience and meet it, we can find our way back to balance and being really with that experience in an open, receptive, connected way. That's the confidence and the trust that we need to build. Not trying to hold on to some sense of okayness, but actually this resilience that we can meet the challenges of life. Well, they will come. So discomfort. So this is the space where we're outside of our comfort zone, but we're not in the overwhelm that I was just speaking about. It's that edge. And we all know it's that little, oh, you know, not quite easy, not quite natural, can't just rely on habit. And it's actually a really interesting place to be in if we can bring our mindfulness to it and not immediately run away to finding comfort. Meditation as a process that leads to deeper and deeper seeing, leads to awakening, is inherently a destabilizing process. Again, we might come to meditation wanting more peace and ease, connection, great, and it can do that. But as we deepen in our practice, and especially if we go on retreat, and longer retreats even more so, there's a reason that this is called insight meditation. Insight, it's called vipassana, means insight or seeing clearly. Unfortunately, sometimes seeing clearly means we don't like what we see so much. You know, we see the difficulty, the challenge in our habits, in our personality, in our reactivity, whatever it is. And on a very personal level, it can be quite humbling to get to know this mind and to see what it does with not very much, especially, say, on retreat. All of the judging and the aversion and the nitpicking and the liking and the not liking. It can really be quite, as I said, humbling to see that this is what this mind is like. But as we stay with that process, we can bring kindness and equanimity and compassion to that. It can start to deepen where many people go through a kind of life review. All of the difficult things, the challenging things, the unskillful things, the harmful things that you ever did or were done to you, will come up for you in your meditation practice. This is not easy to be with. Many of us have locked those away in the black box, not to be opened. And here they are in the silence of the retreat. So it can be really challenging. But our willingness, again, to be on that edge, to be in that place of discomfort with that. And I can remember when this process happened in a very dramatic way for me. It was like I would have done anything to not feel or think those thoughts, to get away from those memories and those realizations. But it was incredibly healing for me to go through that process. Brings this deep acceptance. This is how things were. This is what happened. Brings a lot of compassion and healing. So a huge amount of work on the personal level can happen through this kind of meditation that's not just being in our comfort zone and feeling nice and easy. It's actually really challenging. And then it can deepen also on the impersonal level, where we start to see things as they really are. And the Buddha points us again and again to see what he called the three characteristics or marks of existence, that things are impermanent, unstable, inherently unreliable, and that there's nothing solid at the core of anything, of me, of you, of the chair, of the desk. There's this insubstantiality. And we can read about these or think about them, reflect on them, but to actually have them impact us in a deep way through a meditation process, again, can be incredibly destabilizing, can be really uncomfortable. But our willingness to be in that process, to see the wisdom, the truth, to come into alignment with this rather than resist it, this is a doorway to deep opening and great freedom. So even though it can be scary, because it's like, where's the solidity? What do I trust as I open to these deep truths? This is actually the doorway to real freedom. So we're not just looking for comfort in our meditation, not just looking for ease, but this willingness to be a little or even a lot uncomfortable with this level of discomfort. This is the edge where the growth happens, where the insight can really go in, because we're not an automatic pilot anymore. When we're in that train of, I know how this works, I've done this before, you know, second day of retreat, yep, I've got some hindrances, but it'll be okay by tomorrow, I'll be cool, and then I'll get the bliss that comes on the fourth day. When I see people with that kind of attitude, I know they're in, hopefully in for trouble, because it doesn't allow for the truth of the moment. So to really challenge ourselves, whether it's in our daily practice, in our inquiry, in our self-reflection, certainly on retreat. I can remember my first metta retreats now many years ago. I was one of these people who was like metta shmetta, you know, and I don't want loving kindness, and it felt like I'd be living in a Hallmark card with rainbows and unicorns, you know, may every day in every way be better and better. I'm not that kind of person. But after a while I realized there was a reason I felt that way about metta, and perhaps metta was exactly what I needed. So, foolish me, I signed up for 6 weeks of intensive metta at IMS, my first metta retreat. Never done more than a few minutes before. Never sat a metta retreat or anything like that. Over at IMS, our sister center on the East Coast. And it was really difficult for me. I mean, I kind of, you know, the first 2 weeks, 10 days, I was saying, well, it's still building, you know, maybe it's getting better. But after about 2 weeks, I was like, where's the metta? You know, I'm not feeling better. I had this idea of what should be happening, and it wasn't happening. You know, because I, you know, think of metta, especially intensive metta, golden light and the heart open and unconditional love, wasn't happening for me. And I'd go to my teacher and say, I feel kind, you know, a little bit of friendliness. I kind of like the person. And I went into one interview where, you know, I reported kind of in that way. And my memory, of course, the reality was totally different than that, was he kind of said in an exasperated voice, well, why don't you try this? And I took that advice and I walked out, and I still have such a clear memory of going out to my walking path in the garden at IMS and, you know, replaying those words that later I found that, you know, he didn't mean them. But anyway, I took them as him saying, oh my God, you know, let her try that. Maybe that will do something to make this work. And I'm like, oh, this is hopeless. What did I think? How, you know, who was I thinking I am to do 6 weeks of metta, and how do I get out of here? And this is hopeless. I remember watching the school bus go by, like, can I get on the school bus anywhere but here? You know, the planes flying over, anything. Because it was so painful to feel a failure. I even had the thought, could I fake it for a month and just go and say, oh yeah, it's great, metta, love, you know, kindness, from, and then I go. Good, but not that good. So, but I realized that what I had to do was just accept that this was what my metta practice looked like. If I was going to make that bad and wrong, I was going to suffer. I was going to suffer for another month at least, if not a lifetime. And a month is a long time on retreat. Some of you know, day after day, minute after minute, hour after hour, of that kind of thing. I had to accept it. And that acceptance, being willing to be, even though it didn't make it easy immediately, the metta did really deepen. Not in a way I would have expected. Things happened in you know, not my idea of how it should be, but that willingness just to say, this is how it is, can I just be with this, even though it's not easy, it's not what we want. So this willingness to be with the difficulty, whether it's discomfort in the body, you know, and the challenges of that, discomfort in the mind, our own thoughts and feelings. These days it's, you know, all of the terrible things that are happening in the world, the planet. You just have to open a newspaper, look at the internet. You know, it's so hard to stay present, to read about these things on the wars, the cruelty, the environmental degradation, climate change, the prejudice, the intolerance. I mean, it's hard, right? And we just don't want to feel that. It's easier just to turn away. But as practitioners, this is our challenge. How do we stay open? Not to lead us into overwhelm or so intolerable that we numb out, but bring that sense of presence into whatever it is that we're working with so that we can stay open. And to look at the ways what we do to avoid discomfort. And there's a reason why it's called comfort food, right? You know, it's food that's heavy and sweet or salty, a lot of fat, warm, solid, so that we get that heaviness to kind of ground us because we feel so challenged. And comfort food is just one thing we do, right? There's a whole range of things that could be considered comfort food, just zoning out on the internet or the media or watching movies or drugs, you know, all the things that people do to numb out and not feel. These are all trying to get out of their discomfort into a kind of comfort realm. But just to really see, we don't learn, we don't grow if we're just numbing out, if we're just filling ourselves up so we don't have to feel. If we can tolerate discomfort, we can learn anything. We can grow in any way we want to grow. We can open to anything. And I'm not, you know, saying some, you know, push through kind of mentality here. It's a very gentle meeting of experience, but it includes the being willing not to turn away, not to reject, not to resist. So in our meditation, again, we see the power of when something happens, whether it's mental or physical, the immediate response is often, you know, I'm out of here, move, think of something else, distract yourself. And the willingness just to, what is this? What does it feel like? What's this nature? What's this texture? Again, not pushing through, not sitting for hours on end to bring the body into great discomfort, not going into some deeply painful part of your experience if it doesn't feel that there's some stability of mind that you can open to that with. But if there is some willingness, some openness, some place of connection, this is that edge where we can learn so much can happen. So, the valuable thing for us, of course, is being able to navigate, bring mindfulness to all three of these states. The comfort and the ease, it's very important that we know how to use that skillfully in our lives. You know, to have a sense of ease, of well-being, of course, it's essential. The Buddha would say, before people can meditate, they need what he called the four requisites of food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. You know, you need those basics taken care of so that the mind can actually steady and do this practice. But to actually find more ease and acceptance in our lives, this is incredibly important. In touch with things as they are, not trying to manipulate. I like this cartoon from one of the great philosophers of our time. Actually, it's Calvin and Hobbes. I think the philosopher is Hobbes. Calvin is, I don't know what Calvin is. He's a trickster. Calvin is the boy. Hobbes is his imaginary tiger, the voice of wisdom. So here's Calvin and Hobbes climbing a tree. And Calvin is saying, I suppose the secret to happiness is learning to appreciate the moment when they're climbing higher up the tree. I, for example, take great pleasure in being right here, right now, doing what we're doing. And Hobbes replies, of course, you're supposed to be in school right now. And Calvin said, I couldn't appreciate those moments. That's what we often do. You know, we want to be in the moment, but only the kind of moments that actually feel good, right? Our practice is this moment, however it is, whatever its challenge. Not just meditating when we feel good or I want to be mindful of the sunset, but when, you know, something really difficult is happening for us, for someone else, can we actually be there in that really felt sense way? And so we can learn, we can practice using the mindfulness, the meditation, to bring this sense of openness, of acceptance, of calm. As I said before, it's amazing the power of just tuning into your breath. Knowing how the body feels as you're sitting with someone who's suffering or dying. Being in touch with that so we don't get disconnected. Having a familiarity with the range of emotions. Not like these ones acceptable, there's this little narrow band of maybe okay and then the big no, you know, that's not allowed. It's like everything included. And as we open to the full range of experience, then the beautiful qualities of mind and heart that are naturally there, they have the room to express themselves. The qualities of the Brahma-viharas, the divine abidings of loving kindness, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity, as we're more in touch, they naturally express themselves. There's room for them to be there because we're not so constricted and trying to control experience. So kindness and steadiness of attention just naturally develop. But as I said, even these beautiful states are not the goal of what the Buddha taught. They're not the end of the path. He taught that we stabilize the attention, we develop these beautiful qualities of mind and heart so that whatever happens, we can be present for it and use this mind as it's trained and this heart as it's steady to penetrate more deeply into the truth of the moment. The Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics, our own personal inquiry, whatever it is that is catching our interest, our Dhamma-vichaya investigation, this is what we train for and practice for. So we really are in alignment with the Dhamma. Dhamma just means truth, the way things are. And as we're more and more living from that place, we're not so likely to be pushed and pulled by the challenges of life. So learning to tolerate, to actually even welcome discomfort, disease when it comes, dis-ease when it comes. It's actually, again, this doorway. You know, as Jack Kornfield will say, uh-oh, about to grow. You know, it's that sense. Again, for me, just a very simple example is I love to go swimming, especially in oceans, lakes, not so much in pools, but, you know, kind of wild water. And it's always colder than you think it should be, right? No matter how much I want to do it, you get to that point where it's like something in the body says no. You know, it's too cold, don't want to do it, don't know what's in there. And I've done it so many times, you don't listen to that anymore, right? You just go in, and it's always great. Even Stinson Beach, which is so challenging to swim, you get in there until you're numb, and then it's okay. It's okay, you can do it. And for me, I mentioned, you know, working with Philip at Spirit Rock, I go to so many meetings, and I can have resistance to going to meetings, and it's just a mindset. I'm driving on my way to the meeting going, why do I have to go to this meeting? It's not fair, you know, I shouldn't. It's like you're going to the meeting. Don't add more suffering to what's actually happening. So looking at the mind, and now I just see it, oh, that's resistance. It's just a habit pattern. It's a habit pattern that I've developed, but I don't listen to it anymore because it's just suffering to add that to what's happening. So actually choosing experiences that take us out of our comfort zone. I mean, we do, right? It's why we go on holidays, adventure trips, get take a new job, meet new people, do things that where we're not in the comfort zone, not doing something that's familiar, because we know that's where we can grow and change and learn. It's just, if we're just in the same old, nothing is happening. Not being in control. It's actually the truth of things that we're not in control, but habits make us think that we are until something happens where the ship gets turned upside down, and then we're lost because we're so used to clinging to that comfort zone. If we're stretching and challenging ourselves over and over again, there's this just a willingness to be more in the unfamiliar. And it's where we can learn. And what we start to see is failure is not an identity. When we're in this zone of discomfort, we will make, I was going to say mistakes. I mean, they're not even really mistakes. They're just places where we learn. We learn what works, what doesn't work. Unless we're in that zone, we're not going to learn. Most discoveries that happen out of failures. They were trying to find something else and they found this. Einstein said, anyone who has never made a mistake has never tried anything new. So just that willingness to give ourselves the space, the permission to fail, to not be perfect, to not know what's happening, what's the right thing to do. That's the only way we can actually grow and meet these new experiences. And just to see that, as I said earlier, we can open to more than we think we can. Most of the time we're not in life-threatening situations. Sometimes we are, I know, but a lot not. Can we breathe? Can we open? Can we bring a sense of presence? And what a gift we can bring to someone else if they know that we're really there when something difficult is happening. As we develop this continuity of mindfulness, and we do it when we're in our comfort zone, in our discomfort zone, it's more likely to be there as we move into the overwhelm when things are really difficult. We can't expect it to be there if we haven't trained it to be there when we're, you know, that's like driving in the parking lot when you're learning to drive before you go out on the freeway. That's why sitting and practice is so helpful. And then I call it mindfulness when it matters. That the mindfulness as a steadiness of mind is right there when something happens. When there's difficulty, discomfort, we don't immediately contract or fly off. We actually can meet it. The mindfulness is so trained that we know how to be present. We're willing to be present, even if it's not easy, even if it's not comfortable. So we use the breath, we use the body to develop that steadiness of attention. But the main thing is what's happening in the mind. How is the mind relating to this experience? What's happening in the mind? And as we get more intimate with experience, closer to experience, these beautiful qualities develop, compassion, acceptance, and kindness, and this deep inner knowing, this deep sense of confidence, unshakable faith, that we can meet experience. It's not about having the right experience, the best experience. It's knowing you can meet experience, and you know yourself, and you know how to be there for that. I love this poem by the Japanese woman poet Izumi Shikupu, 10th century. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I know myself completely, no part left out. And just that sense of presence, of aliveness, of everything included, no part left out. And so alignment with how things are, in harmony, not resisting, this is the end of suffering. Not being in our comfort zone, not practicing just to be more comfortable, but actually having this sense of confidence and trust that the eight worldly conditions, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, happiness and unhappiness, they will come. But we're not shaken by them, we're not swayed by them, we don't live our lives trying to get the good ones and get rid of the bad ones. Ajahn Chah says true success is we're not affected by them. And so what can develop is actually this sense of well-being and contentment that's much deeper and more profound than comfort. And that's what this practice can lead to. So we have a few minutes before the formal closing of the evening. I'd just be curious, any responses to anything I've said, or particularly any experience you've had where you were in your discomfort zone, out of your comfort zone, and what you learned from that, how that was for you. Yes, over here.
It's funny because I have the opposite experience than you with open water.
Mm.
And I've been training to swim in open water for the last 4 months, and I get really anxious and really scared.
Mm.
And it wasn't until about 3 weeks ago that I was swimming up in Belmar and Keys, and every time I go up there, I just stay really close to the shore, and I wouldn't go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened, but something changed. And all of a sudden, I found myself going further and further away from the shore, and what was coming up wasn't anxiety anymore, but it was excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really cool to see the change.
Yes.
It was unexpected. I don't know how it changed.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, I still veered back every now and then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it was just a really weird experience of just a complete shift in how I thought about it. It was exciting.
Yes.
It was like you say, you feel like a mermaid, and you feel all the excitement of having the water all over you.
Yeah.
And then I get scared again.
Sure.
But it was really cool.
Yeah, yeah. But you could only have that experience because even in those early stages of the training, you were in somewhat of a discomfort zone.
Yeah.
It's like, where's the edge? How close to shore?
Yeah.
And then as we get acclimatized to that and some kind of confidence and trust, that inner knowing just takes, it wasn't a conscious decision, it sounds like. It's just,
I tried to make a conscious decision. I couldn't do a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Exactly, just getting exposed to it.
Yes. Yeah, and that's exactly it. You know, it's not, I'm not trying to say we should push through and do everything that's difficult and go out there and challenge ourselves, but that just willing to be a little on the edge, that's the doorway, and we never know when the opening is going to happen, the change is going to happen. But something has changed now, even though there may still be fear. Of course there can still be fear, but it doesn't hold you in the same way that it did. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Well, in the retreat, like one of the Goenka retreats, the first one I went to, I could not, you know, sitting for so many hours a day and so much discomfort, and I would go out on day seven and say, I can't do this. I would try, I say, negotiate with my body somehow to make this happen. But then at a certain point, sitting, I just said to myself, you know, the truth is I can't do it.
Mm.
I just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I am at this moment of not being able to do it. And that release is starting from the point of I can't do it. Everything, you know, eased.
Lovely, yeah.
It was like, oh, well, yeah, I can't do it, but it's okay. And then I could do it better.
It's amazing, isn't it? So, you know, those retreats are really challenging. Goenka retreats, they make you sit for an hour or more at a time, and there's usually, you know, there's no walking or yoga or anything. And just that feeling, I can't do this. But when he could finally acknowledge that, say it fully, wholeheartedly to himself, I can't do this, something let go. And that's often what happens. We're in some kind of bind about our experience where we don't see possibilities. And to actually soften with the compassion, it just says, this is really hard, I can't do this. That tension actually allows us to then be there in a different way.
I mean, I knew I couldn't do it for days on end, but I somehow could never admit exactly how that I couldn't do it, and just let it go, and be with whatever it was.
And then it's just moment by moment, you know?
Yeah.
Because where we get into trouble on retreat especially is, oh my God, another X days or X hours of this. And yes, we can't bear it. It's impossible. But to actually just say, surrender. This is how it is. And it's painful and I can't do it. Oh, that feels better. Great, thank you. Yes?
That just reminds me of Eckhart Tolle when he had his experience, which is, who is saying
Right.
Who is saying that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And one is feeling the feelings, and the other is saying, "No, I can't take it."
Yeah.
Who is that?
Yeah.
Who's saying that?
So the questioning of the, she's mentioning Eckhart Tolle when he had his awakening. I can't take it anymore. But there was a part of him saying, "Who was saying that?" Just a question. Where is that? Because that's different from the felt sense. And you start to look at what's actually happening and not believe the story so much, because the thought that's saying, "I can't bear it anymore," it's happening, you're bearing it, you know. That's the interesting thing. You know.
So who's saying?
Yeah, and what is saying? Where is that voice? Good. Well, thank you. I hope this was helpful, and appreciate that this group is so alive, and I see all the wonderful things that you do together, service projects and social events, Dharma buddies, all the great things that really make a community thrive. So happy to be part of supporting your practice, and wish you well for the future.
Come back more.
Oh, thank you.